Today's Teisho will be on Case 6 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier, the Umenkwan. Case 6 is entitled, The Buddha Holds Out a Flower. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. I have entrusted this to Mahakashapa. Mumon's comment, golden-faced Gautama, really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and sold dog meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted his true eye? Again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say that the true eye of Dharma can be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkin. You say it cannot be transmitted, and why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile. As some of you might know, we have meditation at a number of different locations, and in addition to this one. So we have meditation three times a week in the evening here, and during the school year we have three times in the morning here, and then every other Saturday. But also we have meditation in Cranford, at the Cranford Dance Academy on South Avenue. We have meditation in Franklin Park and in Kingston. Also, we have meditation in Blairstown up north, which is north of Route 80. And that's on Sunday morning. We also have sitting here Sunday morning. We hold meditation up there in a yoga studio. And sometimes we get a fairly good turnout. It's mostly people who have been doing Zazen meditation for a long time, but occasionally a new person comes. And on one occasion, this young couple came, and they were really an interesting couple because they looked like they had stepped out of a time machine, and they had gone into the time machine in about the 1970s, and they had come out of the time machine, you know, just before they came to do meditation, because they looked like they were hippies, you know. And the guy had a beard. He was very young, you know, but he had a long beard. And he was wearing a t-shirt and pants, you know, like jeans. And the woman had a skirt, like a loose skirt, and a blouse that was embroidered. And I had driven up to the parking lot when they drove up. And they didn't have a van with flowers on the side or anything like that. But they got out of their car, and it was just like so exciting to see, because of course that was the period when I was young, the 70s. And they looked like people I would have gone to college with, you know. And so when they got out of their car, I was very excited, you know. I don't dress like that anymore. I don't have a beard and I don't have long hair. But I felt a kinship with them, you know. And so, you know, when they came into the Zendo, I was very excited to see them. I thought, oh, now here are some people who will really get into Zen meditation, you know. And so I explained what to do. I told them to how to sit on the cushion and how to breathe through the Dantian. And we went through that, you know, introduction. And then we did three periods. Up there we do three periods of meditation with a 10-minute break. So we start at 7 and we end at 9, around 9 o'clock. So a little bit before 9. And then, anyway, they came and they went through that. And I thanked them for coming, and they left. And then the next week, they came back. And I was so happy. I thought, oh, they've come back. That's great. So we went through meditation again, and at the end of the session, I said, how did it go? And the guy said, oh, it was pretty hard for me. And he said, this is pretty difficult for me. He said, it's hard for me to focus, it's hard for me to sit still. But then I talked to the young lady, the young woman, and she said, you know, after I meditated last Sunday, I went home, and my whole day was just so beautiful. And she said everything about it was just changed. And of course I thought, yes, yes, that's exactly right. And then I never saw them again. Right? That happens sometime, you know. There was a young woman who came here. She had been coming here on and off, intermittently, while she was a student at Rutgers, and now she's graduated from Rutgers, and she lives down south in southern New Jersey, about maybe 2 hours from here. So she came up here and she stayed with a friend, and then she came to our Saturday meditation. And at the end of the Saturday meditation, I went up to her and I said, how did it go? She said, that was wonderful. That was, what a wonderful experience. And I thought, yes! Right? So I haven't seen her since. Now I wonder, I have to say, I wonder why that is. You know, I can't, first of all, I'm not interested in converting anybody to anything. So, whether people ever consider themselves quote-unquote Buddhists or not is totally unimportant to me. Totally. I'm being very truthful about this. But Zazen, the practice of meditation, has helped me enormously. And I would say that it opens up an amazingly different world to anybody who does it for a long time. Really quite amazing. I have been doing meditation for 30 years, more than 30 years, and that's not like a boast. It's just that I get up every day and I'm eager to do my meditation. I'm eager. And when I do it, I feel wonderful. Sometimes it's just It's just like a bomb going off in my body. It just feels so wonderful. And then, of course, the whole day is nicer. Right? So this is pretty remarkable, in my opinion. My day was very different 30-some years ago, my typical day. You know? I was, I think, reasonably unhappy person, and stressed out, tense, sometimes depressed. I don't think I was clinically depressed, but I think I was depressed sometimes. And so, you know, when I started to do meditation, I just wanted to get out of pain, the pain I just described. And it was very difficult for me. Physically it was difficult, psychologically, but 30 years later, it's really a wonderful world, really. And it's never boring. I love sitting, and every time I sit down on the cushion, it's a new experience, and it's wonderful. So my personal feeling is that whether somebody calls himself or herself a Buddhist or a Zen Buddhist is really not terribly important. That's like an existential decision for that person, you know. But I do think Zazen is really quite amazing, and I think that it really does bring you a kind of, opens up a kind of reality, that is not accessible, that was not accessible to me before I started doing Zazen. So when I meet people who have an interest in doing Zazen, you know, I'm always very excited, because I think, you know, the world on the other side of this practice is pretty amazing place. And I'm usually pretty straight with people. I usually tell, you know, the truth is, you know, 10 years is, after 10 years you're a beginner in Zen. If you hang in there, it's really, you'll be amazed. And you'll say, oh, this was a small price to pay for this happiness. I run into people like that woman, the hippie woman. And you know, she told me, she looked at me and she said, my whole day was transformed. You know, my whole day was changed. And this woman who came here said, how did it go this morning? And, you know, there's no reason people, I mean, maybe people feel under pressure to give me a good report, you know. But there's no reason she couldn't have said, well, I have my reservations, or... But she said, that was absolutely wonderful. And then they disappear. Now, I think this is because there's a huge gap between our culture and the practice of meditation. Now, I think it's enormous, you know. And so even when people sit down on the cushion and they have this wonderful experience, when they go home, my guess is they go home and it doesn't make that much sense. In fact, maybe a couple weeks later they might think, gee, did I just imagine that? Did I just imagine that? Was that all just, what was that all about? You know, and I think it's because our culture is so far from understanding this, you know. We have a society that is very, very based on ideas. Ideas are so important to people in the West, in the modern world, you know. As we put an incredible premium on ideas. You know? So, you know, people respect, you know, people in our culture very much respect ideas, even if we don't read a lot and think a lot. We have a kind of like reverence for ideas. A lot of people just spend their lives tracking down ideas. You know, so like I'm an English teacher, I'm an English professor. And if you come into my office, there's a huge number of books on the shelf, some of which I've actually read. And if you go to other professors' offices, you'll often see even more books than I have. And there's, you know, you can pull off the shelf Heidegger or Nietzsche, or Plato, you know. And it's all very impressive. You know, people are normally very impressed by this. Normally, I've had students who come in and go, "Oh, are these all your books? You must be very smart," you know. And, you know, we, you know, there used to be a store, I don't know if it's still around, but what was it called? Something like Baby Einstein, something like that. You know, we have this tremendous reverence for, like, knowledge. And it goes back a long way, you know. I have read a lot of stuff, and one of the things I've read was, you know, like early in our history, like if you read Plato, he's very interesting because he says, you know, only ideas are real. Plato actually says that. He says, you know, a chair isn't real. This is amazing, you know, if you read this. But he actually says this. This is the foundation of Western culture. Plato says a chair is not real. It's merely a shadow of the real chair which exists in heaven. And Plato says, in heaven there's an idea of a chair which is a true chair. And all chairs on earth are merely crude approximations of that ideal chair. And Plato says, what you should try to do in your life is to leave behind the life of the senses and enter a life of true thought, which is pure thought, pure ideas with no physical forms. This is the beginning of the West. See, and you know, ever since Plato, you know, we've gone through a lot of transformations. You have science and all this stuff, but you know, behind all of this, there's still this idea. There's still this extraordinary reverence for ideas. You know. And even our educational system supports this in very subtle ways. So, you know, when you go to school, when you're a little boy or a little girl and you go to school, you know, you could have the space of a school organized in many different ways. You know, you could sit on the floor. Sometimes, like in quote-unquote experimental schools, kids sit on the floor. They can sit wherever they want. The floor is carpeted, the kids can lie down and things like that. But if you go to a conventional school, all the desks are lined up in rows, right? And you spend your whole time, except for gym, right, and lunch, and even lunch, you're sitting, spend your whole time sitting in a chair, working with ideas, right? And you learn, you learn in this environment, which is very arid, you know, very dry. You know, there's often in classrooms there's very few windows, or the windows are, you can't really, they're high up so you can't see out. And the teacher's just presenting like pure concepts, like 5 + 2 - 1 is, or you're reading and you're listening to a story and you're being being asked to answer questions, you know. Or you're reciting, you know. So it's all about ideas. And it all takes place in like a closed up room. And it doesn't really involve your body. In fact, you know, little kids squirm at their desks, they're very restless and so on. It's hard for them to concentrate, and they like to talk, you know. So, in lower grades, you know, if the teacher loses control of the classroom, it explodes into chatter, right? You know, and the teacher has to, like, you know, get over, restore order and make people quiet. You know, if you fast forward 12 years, people are like seniors now. And they've learned how to sit at the desk, you know, and pretend to focus on ideas or focus on ideas. And they're lost. You know, when I was in school, sometimes I paid attention to the teacher, but a lot of the time I would just drift into this like mental movie, you know. And of course, I would look at my watch and think, soon I'll be home, you know. And you know, I would have moments when I was really engaged. You know, I would get excited about ideas and so on. But the whole experience is rather odd if you think about it. Because it's so focused on one very narrow kind of understanding. You know, one very narrow kind of learning. And it's all like head work, you know, it's all head work. And outside of school, you know, you have stimulation from all these different sources, like television, movies, you know, and so on. It's interesting to me that it's like there's the world of ideas which takes place in school, and then there's this world outside of school which is like a very chaotic, indiscriminate experience. It's like a lot of, in my high school, there were people who used to drink on the weekends. They used to like get drunk on the weekends, kids. And in my high school also there were like dopers, you know, who would bring, it's so immature, right? You know, they'd bring some reefers to school, and they'd sneak out in the back, you know, and smoke a reefer. You know, it was so exciting. They'd come into class stoned. You know. This is like rebellion against ideas, right? Against that very narrow world, right? Getting drunk on the weekend, getting stoned. You know, this is like a protest, right? But it was like, if you've ever, you know, when I was in college, we would sit around and get stoned, and it's such a boring thing to do, really. You know, you come in, everybody sits down, you get stoned, you listen to a record, you get something to eat, you know, and then you go to sleep. Yeah. It's not very creative. So anyway, I think that our culture doesn't really appreciate how much richer and more beautiful life can be, and how many doors we close on ourselves, you know. Tomorrow I'm going to give a talk to a group of Unitarians in Edison. They've invited me on Sunday. Instead of going up to Blairstown, I'm going to give a talk to the Unitarians. And Unitarians are interesting. You know, they're very nice people. They believe that all religious traditions have a truth, express the truth, you know, in different forms. And so, like, Unitarians will read the Bible, they'll read the Gita, they'll read Buddhist sutras, they'll read Native American materials, you know. And I myself have known a lot of Unitarians, and I really respect them because they don't like prejudice. You know, they'll read the Quran, they'll read Zoroaster's teachings, you know, Sikh teachings, you know. They're really very eclectic. But you know, actually, their experience is still very narrow because it's all ideas again, you know. So if you go to a Unitarian service, it's just a guy talking, just like me, you know, just like me talking now. And they listen and they turn those ideas over. I know this because my wife's family, they're Unitarians, as a matter of fact. And I've been to Unitarian services, and you know, there's usually some very interesting speaker. He might talk about like modern physics and God or something like that. And everybody goes and they listen. It's almost like they're going to take notes, you know, and they're very stimulated by this. Yeah. And I'm not putting it down. I think that's wonderful. And that, I actually think that kind of religion is much preferable to religion where people are like, no, this is the truth. You know, this is only this. You know? So it's a great advance over that, but it's still, you know, kind of one-dimensional because it's just about ideas. And I think ideas have a very limited ability to change our lives. You know, I really do. You know, you can read a book. You know, at one point in my life, I was, I just got, ideas were like a drug for me, you know. I grew up on military bases. My father was from New Jersey. He grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey. So he was a Jersey kid. And he served in World War II in the Navy as an enlisted man. And then after the war, he went back to college, and then he worked, he went back to the Navy for many, many years, and then he worked for the Department of the Navy. So I spent a lot of my life on military bases, which are the most boring places in the world. Unbelievable. You know, I've been to like Okinawa, you know, and but you know, I never saw any of Japan because I was on a military base. So I could have been in the United States. I wasn't even allowed off the base. I was in San Diego, and we did go into town sometime, but. You know, Bremerton, the base near Seattle, military bases, you could be, every base is almost the same. And all the kids on there are very bored, and there's actually a lot of drug problems, a lot of crime problems among service families. And so for me, reading was like such a liberation. So I would go home and just, you know, the base was so boring, and I would read these books about, you know, Alexandria, Egypt, and British diplomats in Egypt in the 1930s, you know, and it was so cool, and everybody was having romances and breaking each other's hearts, and there was murder and political intrigue, and I thought, oh, this is what life is going to be, you know. But I just read and read, you know, and I would sort of like come out of this dream state and come down and eat my dinner, and watch Star Trek, and then go back up and read some more. You know? So I was like addicted to ideas, but you know, it created like a very unhappy world for me because the ordinary world was very uninteresting and unhappy, and the world of beautiful ideas, you know, like Proust, you know, it opened, oh, beautiful. You know? And then my reality was really crummy, you know. So I just sort of stayed in my dream world a lot of the time. But this ultimately, I think, made me very unhappy. So I think we really underestimate how rich life can be because we use just like this tiny little part of our intelligence. Something like Zen is really quite different. I'm going to tell these Unitarians, you know, that there's more to life than ideas. You know, when we do meditation, we don't sit in comfortable chairs. We sit on a mat. And we sit on a mat because we're going to use the body as an instrument of awareness, you know? So it's not about mind, even though you might think so. It's about, you know, we have like this big array. You know, there's a telescope called the large array, the big array? But it's a gigantic telescope. And it's actually like a telescope of telescopes because I guess they have multiple telescopes, you know, they're radio telescopes. And they're in these mountain valleys, and there's a system of them. And I think it's called the Large Array. But it's all of these different radio telescopes, and they're all feeding information into this system, right? And they're giant, you know. Well, actually, looking at the world, I think, with just your mind that uses language, is like looking through the world with like a little array. It's like very little information gets in there. And in fact, if you read about how the brain works, the brain is primarily involved in filtering out information. You know, so the body takes in a lot of information, a lot. And the brain is processing that information. And I should have said the conscious mind is like screening out a lot of that, you know. So the body's taking in all this information through your skin, your hearing, smell, touch, you know, all this stuff. And the brain is processing, and conscious mind is screening out a lot, like most of the information. Consciousness is like this tiny little part of our awareness. And then, actually, you know, culture and language very much act as screens too. So they structure experience, which becomes a little too chaotic for us, and makes it easier to process it by putting it in prefabricated packages. So my point is, all this information is coming at us, and at each level, more and more of it is getting screened out and made routine. And by the time it comes to us through language, it's very, very limited. So what we do is to work around that, you know. We try to reconnect with the large array. So when we sit down on the cushion, we're really using the whole body as an instrument. And, you know, the brain is just one part of the nervous system. When we sit down on the cushion and straighten the back and breathe with the Dantian, you're like reorganizing your nervous system. This is not bullshit. This is the truth. You know, you're really, you've trained your body in all kinds of ways, sitting at a desk for 14 years, or it's 12 years and 14 years at the BA or BS level, and then it goes on, right? So, in school, you're really not using all of that awareness. You're really focusing on a tiny little island of information all the time. But you know, Zen is all about tapping into sources of awareness we don't normally tap into. And so when you sit on the cushion, you're activating your body in a different way. The yoga element of this is very significant. It's not trivial. You know, we're awakening nerves that we don't normally awaken. We're putting some to sleep. It's like your body, when you're sitting on the cushion, is just functioning in a very different way than when you're sitting in a chair. And also, Zen is opening up another part of your mind, which we call which is related to the body, the unconscious, right? The unconscious. So, you can come into a room, and you can instantly know that there's been a fight in the room. I've come into rooms sometimes where, you could feel the tension hanging in the air, as they say. And it's because, you know, your body, your senses must pick up maybe smell. You know, you might pick up hormones in the air. You can subtly, without even knowing it, read people's body language, you know. Just the way people hold their bodies can hold many clues to how they're really feeling. And you don't consciously know any of this, but you sit down and you realize this room is tense, or you yourself might come into the room and just suddenly feel very tense without knowing why. There are other examples of this too. You know, you walk outside one day. You know, these last few days here in New Jersey have been so beautiful. Usually in New Jersey, it's swelteringly hot, humid. These days, it's been like 60 in the morning, no humidity. You go outside, you might not notice it's 60, no humidity. But part of you does, you know. And blue sky, you might not think blue sky. But you just feel like you're, you know, connecting to things. There's a kind of deeply a calm, deeply relaxed feeling, like this happiness welling up, right? And a sense of real peace, you know, a real security or joy. Now, all of this is just because of information coming to you that you may never even be consciously aware of, but you find yourself bouncing along as you walk down the street, you know. You find yourself feeling cheerful. You know, you didn't do anything to be cheerful. It's from your relationship with all this information that your body is pulling in. So there's many dimensions to life other than like the head aspect of this, you know. And really, the deepest transformations involve changes on levels that are really below the threshold of consciousness. You know, I was just reading the other day, they had an article in the Huffington Post, I guess it was. You know. But psychologists have done new work on self-esteem books. So if you go to Borders Bookstore, or Barnes and Nobles, there's a huge library of books on feeling better about yourself, you know. And you know, they're just huge. Working on yourself, feeling better, building your self-esteem. And it turns out that these books, psychologists who have studied these books say they're tremendously ineffective, as a matter of fact. That people who use them still have very low self-esteem. And in fact, they said people even become addicted to self-help books. Because what happens is you read the book and you think, okay, I am okay. You know, life is good. You know, right? Yes! You know? But then it wears off. Really, this is what they said. They said it wears off. And then you have to go buy another book, right? And it can't say the same thing. It has to say it differently, you know. So maybe, you know, it's chicken soup for the soul this week, and next week it's I'm okay, you're okay, and, you know. And it's just like this constant turnover of affirmative ideas, right? But they said this doesn't work. You know, they said people with low self-esteem, they go back to, like, this baseline of low self-esteem. And I think that's because the power of language and ideas is so shallow, you know. And actually, when I was a boy, I had many problems, like everybody else, and I went to a wonderful psychiatrist, Dr. Kriegman was his name. And he taught at the University of Richmond. My father was stationed at the Naval Weapons Station. And he worked, I guess, with a number of service kids who were all screwed up. And so he had a connection to our base. He actually lectured. He was a professor, actually, at the University of Richmond and a practicing psychiatrist. And he was a wonderful man, and he helped me enormously. But I do know friends who have gone to analysis for years and years and years and years. And they still have lots of anxieties and fears. And I realize that, you know, as soon as we get rid of one set of fears, we start producing a new one. You know, so. But the fact is that I wonder if sometimes analysis is very shallow. You know, because it's just ideas. Even if you understand the games you play with yourself, if you can, I know, this is my usual routine. I always do this with myself. It doesn't necessarily stop you from doing it. So I think even like psychoanalysis, for which I have enormous respect, has a limit because it just often just works with ideas. And you know, I think Zen goes a little deeper because we're working. It's like we're re-educating the body, and we're drawing on all of this. We're working on ourselves on a subconscious level. Now, what this means is very strange. You know, a woman came to sit, and she said, after I sat, I had the most wonderful day, and she didn't come back. And I think it's because she just doesn't, given our cultural assumption, she just didn't get it. You know, this is much better than reading, I'm okay, you're okay. Because my feeling, my personal feeling is that the more you do this, the better you're going to feel. It makes like I feel like a deep and enduring change. But, a lot of the process of Zen is not conscious. So somebody will, if you study with me, at some point I will give you a koan, what's called a koan. And I might ask you something like this. I might say, if you have a stick, I will give you one. And if you have no stick, I will take it away. So if you have a stick already, I'll give you one. And if you have no stick, I'll take it away. So your job is to sit down on the cushion and enter samadhi and go, give, take, give, take. Okay? And you might try to figure it out. You might think, oh, I understand. See, I get it. You're trying to say, don't hold on, right? Don't hold on to things, right? Sometimes you give, sometimes you take. Okay! Right. Well, if that's all there is to Zen, it's pure BS, right? Because it's just like it's pure BS. You know, because you already knew that. You don't have to do any meditation to interpret the koan. Okay? But that's not what koans are about. Koans are really about, like, you're supposed to take that into your mind. You keep going, give, take. Give, take. You enter samadhi, and hour after hour, you keep saying, give on the out-breath, take on the next out-breath, give on the, okay. So this drops down into the mind, and it's down there in your subconscious, percolating. And even when you're working at your job, it's still in there, really. Every time you come back to the cushion and you return to your koan, you're like renewing your connection to the magical jewel which is down there in your subconscious, percolating. But it's going all the time if you keep working with it, even when you're like sleeping. And it's making a change. But the conscious mind can't really see it. It can't. And we want to understand, we Western people put so much emphasis on ideas, because remember Plato, only ideas are real, right? So if we could just explain it coherently, we would understand it, right? But actually, very few things in life, some things need to be explained coherently, like physical processes, instructions for assembling devices. There's a place for that. But in life, there are many things that are too big for that. You have to use the very large array. And much of that processing is below the threshold of consciousness. And so, you're working with this koan and you're working with your koan, and all of a sudden, something comes out. And you don't know where it's coming from, and it just sounds crazy. And right? You think, well, that's crazy. And then you come into Dokusan and you say something that might seem unrelated to the koan or just crazy. And then the teacher might say, ah, excellent, that's a very good answer. And you think, why? I don't understand. But if you go through this process enough times, your life just becomes quite different. You notice that you're processing things in like a different way. You just are. And if you have problems with being down in the dumps or depressed or fearful, or one day you go, oh yeah, I used to be depressed. I wonder where that went. I used to be so afraid. I wonder where that went. I used to be so anxious all the time. And then you get anxious about not being anxious, right? But after a while, you're not even anxious about not being anxious. I should be anxious. I might be slipping. I might be losing my grip because I'm not terrified all the time. So, So this is like different, you know, coming here. I want to say I'm so glad everybody came here this morning. And coming here to hear this talk, I'm so glad you came. Well, please remember, a talk is can only do so much. Yeah? I mean, I actually encourage people to read books on Zen if they inspire you to practice. You know, like in the first 10 years of my practice, I would get a Buddhism book and just read it, just so it just sort of like made me want to keep practicing. It's like inspiring, but it didn't help me at all with my practice. So if you want to read books on Buddhism, by all means, but it really is very shallow. You know, that the ability of that to really help or transform things is really very shallow. You know, when I was living in Seattle, our Zen group had connection with a Tibetan group in town, and there were, in that Tibetan group, there were like Dalai Lama junkies, you know? And they would actually, like, when the Dalai Lama came within like a hemisphere away, they would spend money and get on planes and go to hear him talk, you know? I love the Dalai Lama, but I think that's such a fantasy, you know? I mean, what is he going to say that can really change your life? I was just reading about the Dalai Lama the other day, and you know, he does like 4.5, maybe 5 hours of meditation every day. I was impressed. It used to be 4. He's actually added since I last read. It was some magazine I was reading. I was in a doctor's office taking my father-in-law to the doctor, and it was some magazine like, you know, I don't know what, Esquire or something, and there was How the Dalai Lama Spends His Day. But he gets up at 4:30, and he takes a shower. And I thought that was interesting right away. And then he has some tea, and then he does like 1.5 hours of meditation, and then he listens to the BBC for 1 hour, and then he does like 2 hours of meditation, you know. And then at night he does a couple hours. So he really is like meditating all the time. And he's the Dalai Lama. Yeah. So he knows that, you know, he's not doing it to get to advance his understanding of a Buddhist philosophy. It's a deeper mode of experiencing reality. It's a really different way of life. He wouldn't be doing it if he didn't like it. Talks can't really do it. There's nothing anybody could say that could awaken you. What can awaken people is zazen, is meditation, what we call meditation, which is actually rather complicated. But it means entering this larger mind and then investigating reality. So Zen is all about like entering deep samadhi, which is non-dual, not no longer separate from the world, more integrated body-mind awareness, and then investigating, just like a scientist, investigating various aspects of the moment. And the koan is like a subconscious clue or cue that helps you work through your barriers and see things as they really are. The Buddha was at Vulture Peak when Shakyamuni, that's his name in East Asia, Siddhartha Gautama, was called Shakyamuni, sage of the Shakya tribe, Shakya group. Okay. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Vulture Peak, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. They were waiting for him to talk. only Mahakashyapa broke into a broad smile, because he understood you can't, it can't be conveyed in words and ideas. It can't. But we have a bigger mind, and with a lot of work, it can be in reality can be encountered. Yeah? And so the Buddha says, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, the subtle Dharma gate. See, now that's the BS part of it. Right? So everybody thinks, oh my God, the subtle Dharma gate, what could that be, you know? So if it sends them to the library, the Buddha has failed. If it sends them on a road trip to hear the Dalai Lama, the Buddha has failed. If it sends them to the cushion, now that's it. Because I have given this to Mahakashyapa. Everybody thinks, what? Okay. And then in Zen, by the way, I have to wrap up, but this study that said self-help books don't work actually had another very interesting detail. They said that when therapists and social workers tell you good news about yourself, if you think it's bullshit, it doesn't help. So if they go, you're really a very kind person, you know, and you think, no, I'm not, it doesn't help. In fact, it makes you even more depressed. Isn't that interesting? So actually, sometimes complimenting people doesn't work, right? If they already have issues, you know, if you say, you're really a fine person, you know, if a person, a lot of people don't go, maybe I am, you know. They actually go, oh, come on, you're full of bull too, you know. So anyway, Mulman's approach is very different. Instead of trying to compliment everybody, he insults everybody. Right? He does. It's a classic Zen. So he says, golden-faced Gautama. So he's really saying the Buddha's really great. But he says, the golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and sold dog meat as though it were mutton. Right? So it's like cheap meat as though it were expensive meat. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed at his ridiculous statement about the true Dharma eye, how could he have transmitted the true Dharma eye? And again, if Mahakashyapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you try to figure this out with your discriminating mind, you're getting nowhere. So please sit on the cushion, which is what we've done today. Holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. In other words, he's complimenting the Buddha by saying the Buddha's like a monster, right? Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashyapa's smile. Being bewildered is such a great thing. Not understanding. There's two different kinds of not understanding. One is just being very stupid and unaware, right? That's true. There's another kind of not understanding which is bigger than understanding. Right? So, you know, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says you have terminal cancer, right? You can get out the medical book and you can go through and you can understand your condition, right? And that's fine, but that's not what you want, right? There's a bigger way of responding to that problem. And you can be depressed, you can be miserable, you can feel cheated, you can be angry. People can tell you, oh, you're going to a better place. And that's, in my opinion, pure baloney. Right? But, you know, if you sit down on the cushion, I have known people. I'm speaking from, I haven't had cancer, but I've known people who died of cancer who were, you know, Zen monks. And you sit down on the cushion and you sit. And you know, again, hasn't happened to me, but I have definitely known people who were up to this challenge. You know, get off the cushion, and this world is a beautiful world, beautiful world. Even in that situation, and that's working through. That's a deeper than understanding, right? So anyway, that's. What the Buddha was trying to illustrate when he was holding up that flower. So everybody came here today to practice Zen, or to hear about Zen, and I thank you all for coming, and I hope you come back very, very, I hope you come back, right, very, very soon, and practice this beautiful path.